This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett. As the world staggers blearily from the carnage caused by the pandemic, Asian economies offer some interesting opportunities for investors.
So if you are a believer in continued strength in the connected world and the requirement for computer hardware, then you would want to be looking to Taiwan and Korea, with perhaps less now than you would have done aside order some China stuff.
In April, analysts hiked 12 months earnings estimates for Asian economies by the largest amount in 5 months, Refinitiv data showed, as manufacturing activity and demand for the region's exports rose. The big upgrades came as regional economies such as South Korea, Taiwan and Vietnam saw an increase in factory output and shipments thanks to a rise in demand from developed economies, which are making a fast recovery from the coronavirus. But it's not just about the short-term opportunity. Home to nearly 4.7 billion people and over 2 billion middle class, basically the people who earn and spend the most, Asia could become the epicentre of global consumption for decades to come.
If you draw an analogy to sports, if you talk about Federer and Hamilton, the question has always been, who's next in line? And if you apply that question to the economic landscape, the answer is Asia. Asia either next in line or already has been there.
And rather than remaining reliant on the West, Asia is now backing itself. Asia now trades more within its own region than it does with the rest of the world.
China and 14 other countries have agreed to set up the world's largest trading bloc, encompassing nearly a third of all economic activity in a deal many in Asia have seen a recovery as a result of the pandemic. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership was signed virtually on Sunday.
60% of goods traded by Asian companies are within the region, according to McKinsey. It's not just economically. The United States and its Western allies are increasingly concerned about growing cooperation between Russia and China in areas of common interest.
The foreign ministers of China and Russia have praised ties and called for more bilateral support amid the pandemic. Wang said relations between China and Russia should remain stable in a volatile world. Wang noted how China and Russia helped one another amid the pandemic and achieved results.
China remains a significant driver of Asian growth, but other nations look set to prosper.
There's a lot more potential in Asia. When looking beyond China and India, some of the interesting markets are perhaps Indonesia. Vietnam is another economy which could do well. Countries like Bangladesh or Pakistan.
And the pandemic has accelerated some disruptive trends from which Asian economies should benefit. In this show, Nick Field, an emerging market strategist, Paramesvar Viswanathan, head of investment in Asia with Schroeder Advec, and economist David Rees discuss why Asia could be set to dominate the 21st century, from what's driving growth to where investors could find the best companies to invest in. But in part one, we're going to explore how Asia rebuilt itself from the ruins of a crisis in the late 90s to become a competitor to the West today.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
When people think of Asian growth and investment these days, they think mainly about China. But that's not always been the case. You only have to go back to the 1990s to discover how different investing in Asia was in the decade that would come to define the region.
So the most obvious thing, when you think about investing in Asia back in all the way back in the 1990s, was that the countries you'd be investing in were completely different to what you'd be looking at now.
That's Nick Field, an emerging market strategist at Schroders. He says back then it was all about up-and-coming economies. Japan had had its growth spurt and was struggling with a banking crisis.
The real growth and investment opportunities came from the likes of Korea and Taiwan and the so-called Asian tigers such as Malaysia and Thailand.
That's David Rees, an economist at Schroders. He points out that China in the 90s was just a twinkle in the eye of the global economy. The country was only 10 years into opening up to foreign trade and investment and implementing free market reforms. As a share of global growth, China's GDP accounted for just 1.3% in 1990, according to the World Bank. Compare that with 21% for the US at the same time.
And then, of course, the Asian crisis hit and it all blew up.
Southeast Asia's market turmoil. How did it all begin?
In Thailand, forced to devalue its currency because it ran out of reserves to defend the baht, its currency, from speculative attacks.
Bangkok stock prices went into a free fall, and eventually the baht tumbled. The problems experienced by Thailand soon spilled over to its neighbors.
The fact that it spread to the other countries is perhaps not terribly surprising, given that they had fundamental vulnerabilities, specifically large current account deficits.
It's like an earthquake. I have the feeling we are just at the beginning of it.
The Asian financial crisis began in 1997. The first sign of trouble was the Thai currency, which fell nearly 40% in early July of 1997. It marked the start of a domino effect that rippled through the region. Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines were all dragged into the maelstrom. Even Singapore and South Korea, despite their comparative economic strength, were drawn in too. The origins of the crisis stemmed from the popularity of what was essentially an arbitrage trade. Companies and investors saw what they thought to be a risk-free deal. Sound familiar?
It was one of the most profound events in generations, with huge consequences for the American economy and households throughout the country. This was the time a decade ago when the financial crisis erupted, a crash that most experts did not foresee. Its effects and of the recession that followed on income, wealth, inequality, and our politics are still with us. Tonight,
there's no such thing as easy money. The problem was, a lot of countries in Asia became overly dependent on continued inward flows of foreign currency. The key symptom was the build-up of a large current account deficit, as excess demand and speculation was funded by attracting capital from offshore. To coin a phrase, as soon as the music stopped, the money that had been pouring in simply stopped and reversed. Credit was withdrawn and currencies collapsed. What made matters worse is that investment was squandered by profligate companies. As a result of the crisis, many nations adopted protectionist measures to ensure the stability of their currencies.
So after the Asian crisis, Asia took a huge step backwards economically. It took a long time for the countries and the corporates to restructure debt, and the investment opportunities were obviously somewhat reduced prior to the Asian crisis.
A lot has changed in the 20 years since the crisis began. Critically, the countries involved are now in much better shape. Asia understands that it shouldn't be so reliant on foreign inflows.
The Asian economy has seen a huge change over the last 20, 30 years.
That's Parameswar Viswanathan, or Param for short. He's head of Investments Asia at Schroeder Advec.
If you draw an analogy to sports, if you talk about Federer and Hamilton, the question has always been, who's next in line? And if you apply that question to the economic landscape, the answer is Asia. Asia either next in line or already has been there. If you look at the countries who dominated the world landscape back in the 80s, it was Japan, Germany, the United States. But fast forward 30, 40 years, now the top three countries by purchasing power parity is China, US, and India.
China has undoubtedly led the Asian recovery. Following its free market reforms, it developed into a major exporter.
And that saw a real push in commodities globally. China began to demand a huge amount in commodities, so it started to have a real impact on the world economy.
In 1997, China's share of global exports was just 3.3%, according to United Nations data. By 2020, that had grown to nearly 15%, almost twice as much as the US. China's GDP went from $1.7 trillion to $11.5 trillion in the same period, according to World Bank data, second only to the US. But while the recovery has been led by China, it's not the only player in the Asian game.
I think the next century is about the whole of Asia and not just China, because Asia is very diverse and a very large place. Beyond that, I think, you know, some of the original Asian tigers, such as Korea and Taiwan, they're much smaller economies, but they've been performing extremely well. And actually, they've been able to continue industrialization and reform momentum to avoid the middle-income trap. And are practically developed economies now.
But what has driven the Asian resurgence?
I think the three biggest drivers have been, one, an opening up politically and economically to the rest of the world. There have been huge changes in the past 30 years. Related to that, whereas Asia started as kind of just a pool of cheap labour that would assemble goods for other countries, we've seen Asian economies transform from just assembly hubs to developing their own products. And third, and probably related to this, we're now seeing Asian economies become innovative and kind of push the frontiers of technology. So they've gone really from being the workshop to the kind of the developer.
So that's how Asia recovered from the economic disaster 3 decades ago. But what could make the 21st century belong to Asia? That's what we'll discuss in part two.
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website shorters.com/investor download.
Asia is definitely set to dominate the 21st century. It's not just about the growth that matters, but also the composition of that growth that matters. And so we believe the four M's are set to transform these economies.
The four M's Param's referring to are millennials, middle class, metropolitan, and mobile. So let's start with why millennials.
Demographics has been a big precursor to growth. Asia is home to 800 million millennials, and compare this to the West, you have 60 million in Europe, or maybe another 60 million in the US. Compare that to, you know, China with 300 million millennials. Half of India is under 25 years of age. And it's not just about the millennials. Now, if you look at the Generation Z, 90% of them live in emerging markets, and they're going to add another $30 trillion to the consumption economy by 2030. And so these are really huge numbers that are going to drive consumption going forward.
But while millennials, those born roughly between 1980 and 2000, and Gen Zers, those born after 2000, are the future, it's the middle class that could be the powerhouse of the Asian economy in the 21st century.
The expansion of the middle class in Asia is rapidly powering the growth in consumption.
If we think about the middle class in Asia, some work by the World Economic Forum thinks that the middle class in Asia will go from 2 billion people in 2020 to around 3.5 billion people by 2030. And the Brookings Institute think that about 90% of the new middle class entrants in the world in the next 10 years will come from Asia.
And by 2025, this middle class consumption in Asia is going to overtake the rest of the world.
And then there's the metropolitan class, those individuals that are leaving provincial towns and moving to cities in search of better education, better opportunities, and higher pay.
Asian growth is rapidly being powered by urbanization as more workers go to cities to pursue their dreams. And so if you just look at the Asian landscape, you have 300 cities alone that have 1 million people living in them, and compare that to the US and Europe that have less than 20 each. This urban growth, this urbanization, this pattern is going to foster a virtuous cycle that of scale, faster products, cheaper products, and that actually gives businesses a chance to scale much faster than you'd see in any other part of the world. Maybe I would quote an example of Didi in China, where you have today maybe around 30 million drivers or even more. That's 10 times more than Uber's. And all of this just by focusing on China.
Finally, there's the proliferation of mobile phones and technology that's helped bring millions out of poverty.
Asia has 4 billion mobile phone subscriptions and 2 billion internet users. And this is a scale that's much more than in any other part of the world. In China, for example, they're now the world's largest mobile payments market with companies like Alibaba and Tencent having their own platform play. India is reportedly the number one country in terms of data use per consumer at 11 gigabytes per user per month. And it's also the world's cheapest telecom rates at 25 cents per gigabyte. Jio, for example, a telecom player, has recently received $25 billion in funding from large corporates like Google and Facebook to exactly enable that change as well. The keys to unlocking this massive opportunity is to closely align yourselves with the growth opportunity driven by the four M's. This means investing in sectors like consumer, technology, and healthcare that provide quality goods and services at affordable prices. Technology has been a key success factor for most of these businesses.
But where can investors find those businesses when they're looking to invest in Asia? That's what we'll discuss in the final part of the show. As we've heard, Asia is a broad landscape, and investing in Asia is more than just about China growth. It's made up of many different countries, each specialising in its own sector of the market.
There's a nexus in North Asia of Korea, Taiwan, to some degree Japan and China, of manufacturing and research into all things semi-computing and a lot of global consumer electronics. For example, TSMC in Taiwan is the leading manufacturer of microprocessors, semiconductors, and it supplies companies all over the world and in turn is supplied by a number of companies in that North Asia nexus. So if you are a believer in continued strength in the connected world and the requirement for computer hardware, then you would want to be looking to Taiwan and Korea, with perhaps less now than you would have done a side order of some China stuff because of the geopolitics of that sector as well. And then if you are interested in some small sectors, IT services and so on, you could look at India. In fact, you could look at India for all of these things because India, to some degree, marches to its own tune and has a good range of stocks in all sectors. Now, you may or may not like them. But in terms of the business and the industry that India does, it does a bit of everything. The one thing it doesn't do, I would say, is computer hardware. That you really do need to stick with your careers in Taiwan's for.
But it's more than just about the cliché tech and consumer electronics. It's probably not escaped your notice, but the world is facing an inflation dilemma.
Now, runaway inflation, is that something that could potentially be a bigger risk down the line?
I think it's the biggest risk seen of facing investors beyond this year. And I would put decent odds that it could get out of control and require the Fed and other policy officials, the bond market, to knee-jerk in order to shut down the overheat and prematurely abort the recovery in the bull market.
If you are more of the view that you're going to get a big reflation and that all of the money that's being produced for COVID relief will continue and that there'll be infrastructure push, and that you'll be looking at higher inflation rates and you're interested in perhaps commodities and perhaps older businesses than that, then there are still some bits of China that are there. They're obviously somewhat less favoured over recent years. But you could also look for some soft commodities and various other things around Indonesia, even bits of Malaysia, although perhaps that's a little more of a reach. An example here would be Chinese coal companies. Coal is obviously a very unfavoured sector in the long term and one which has numerous concerns regarding ESG and is indeed arguably being phased out in many parts of the world. Nonetheless, as part of that reflation trade, we have seen those coal companies do very well just on the back of expected better economic growth. So you're looking for companies like China Coal Energy here and a number of others around the region as well. As well as the commodity names, we should also expect banks in the region to do well from the reflation trade. Banks often perform better when rates are going up, particularly since governments have generally supported things and non-performing loans have not therefore been too much of a problem. So here there are all sorts of names. All the countries have banks, some at quite reasonable valuations. So you might be looking at something like Bank Mandiri or Rakyat in Indonesia or Kazakhstan Bank and some others in Thailand. But generally speaking, banks across the region should be considered to do well in reflation trade, as long as, of course, we don't see inflation getting out of control.
So Asia presents plenty of opportunities, but that doesn't mean it doesn't come without risk. Despite Asia being less reliant on foreign investment than it once was back in the 90s, it can still suffer a wobble on any signal that the Western world might begin to tighten its purse strings.
Well, I think the problem that they have is that at some point they are going to have to turn the dial back away from significant accommodation. And when they touch that dial, or when they're perceived to about to touch that dial, markets are going to react. So I think it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to avoid a bond taper tantrum. You're either all in or you're not. And at some point, the Fed's not going to be all in. And when that happens, markets are going to react.
In 2013, Ben Bernanke, the then chairman of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, announced that the Fed, at some point, would start to reduce or taper the amount of asset purchases it was making. In so doing, the Fed chair learned an important lesson in how not to script an exit strategy. Investors, spooked that the world's largest buyer of bonds was apparently exiting stage left, reacted badly. US Treasuries immediately sold off, and the value of the US dollar shot up. Emerging markets suffered, and so did countries in Asia, in particular India and Indonesia, as foreign capital was withdrawn and their currencies depreciated sharply, with hints of the Asian crisis in the late 90s. And there are concerns that if the Fed were to decide to do the same now, it could spark a similar reaction. So there are risks, and it very much depends on where you invest.
The risks are much more just about investing in another country and about the ups and downs of the economic cycle. In a way, they're smaller, or at least less spectacular. You're not likely to turn up one day and discover that the currency is devalued 40% and the bond you owned defaulted. But the one thing I would caution against is deciding too early, and also deciding that whose Asia is it going to be? Which country? As I say, there's more than one. China's absolutely dominant at the moment, but it may not remain so.
There's a lot more potential in Asia. When looking beyond China and India, some of the interesting markets are perhaps Indonesia, which has also got a very large population, and it's also trying to push through a very large reform agenda. And that could really help it to transform from an economy which has performed reasonably well to one that could perform much better, especially if it's able to grab some market share from China in kind of lower end manufacturing if supply chains are shaken up in the region. Vietnam is another economy which could do well. It has benefited already during the kind of trade war years between the US and China by building up some manufacturing. The economy has been performing very well and it has a lot going for it, and that could continue. Countries like Bangladesh or Pakistan, where populations are very large and income levels are very low, these countries are actually on a GDP per capita basis poorer than India. And when you've got these poor economies with large domestic markets, just small changes in terms of reforms could have a big impact in terms of growth. And so if governments there are really able to grasp the nettle of positive reforms that are implemented properly, then those economies and markets could actually do very well.
Which perhaps explains a lot of the tensions rising between the West and Asia, and in particular China. There's the growing influence of China and its attempts to grab power and influence from the US and Europe. And there's the growing unity of Asian economies, which used to rely heavily on the West and are now becoming more self-sufficient. It's no wonder that the West sees Asia as a growing threat to its economic and political dominance.
Well, the main reason the West should be worried about the economic growth of Asia is that it threatens to topple it and displace its dominance in the world economy. Really, we've seen that already between the US and China in terms of the trade war, because China threatens to dethrone the US as the world's number one economy and steal all the political influence that goes with that. And, you know, this issue isn't going to go away over the long term. The faster that Asia grows and the more it catches up with the West, the more it's going to be stepping on the West's toes.
For some, Asia is the future, but for many, Asia is now. Asia's already home to more than half the world's population. It already accounts for half the world's internet users. And of the world's 30 largest cities, 21 are in Asia. And nearly half of the world's 500 biggest companies are in Asia. And by 2020, Asian economies were estimated to be larger than the rest of the world combined. So perhaps the Asian century has already begun. Here's what else investors are talking about. The main drivers of the healthcare revolution remain unchanged. There's an accelerating demand for healthcare services as people are increasingly living longer. But technology, the new insights in the biology of diseases and new treatment modalities, is also driving a tremendous wave of new medicines that offer a step change in patient outcomes. Just as exciting is the use of information age technology to make healthcare provision more efficient and improve quality. You can read fund manager John Bowler's full article, How Tech and Medical Advances Are Transforming Healthcare Investing, at schroders.com/insights, where you can find out much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch with us about anything on the show or give us ideas for future shows, you can email us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. If you want to listen to the Investor Downloads back catalogue, and why wouldn't you? You can go to schroders.com/the Investor Download or rate, review and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every Thursday and every other Monday from 5 p.m. UK time. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.